TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Soil is a living being. Dr. Christine Jones and Farmer Gabe Brown. In the first of these two programs, you heard from Dr. Christine Jones. She's an internationally known ground cover and soils ecologist. She works with and learns from landholders to increase biodiversity and biological activity. They sequester carbon, activate soil nutrient cycles, restore water balance, improve productivity, and create new topsoil. Gabe Brown first started working alongside his father-in-law on the family farm in North Dakota, when a series of crop disasters put Brown and his wife, Shelley, in desperate financial straits. They started, beginning in 1993, experimenting with a new type of farming, regenerative agriculture. Gabe Brown now has been named one of 25 most influential agricultural leaders in the United States. First, here's Dr. Christine Jones from a workshop she gave on soil as a living being to FiberShed. FiberShed is based in San Geronimo in West Marin, California.
So the overall theme, I suppose, of that introductory part of my talk is that all plants and animals, including us, of course, are embedded in a microbial world. Not only do we have microbes on our skin, but we have a microbiome around us that we carry with us everywhere we go. Okay, so we are all embedded in this microbial world, and it's a very, very intelligent microbial world. Much smarter than us, probably. There was a river in South Africa that humans, in their wisdom, decided to divert the entire river for irrigation. It was a river that went out to sea, and they're going, oh, look, all that fresh water, it's just going, it's wasted. Why don't we divert the river, turn the whole thing into one big irrigation system? And when that water stopped flowing down that river, the entire area died because of the transfer of nutrients that you get from the birds and the insects and all those kinds of things you're talking about. We need everything in an ecosystem for it to function effectively. So it's a really, really good point. And we forget about the microbes too, because we think about the things like the trees and the birds and the insects that we can see, but there's this microbial world that we can't see, and we have really just ignored it until recently. Now that we've seen that the wheels are falling off everything, it's like, oh, maybe microbes are important, because, you know, we are embedded in this microbial world, and we have a microbial world embedded within us as well. This is actually a very good thing, because microbes are capable of performing all kinds of amazing tasks that we can't do. And they behave collectively. Even though if we took a bacteria, for example, it's just a single cell. You think, how could one little tiny single cell, it's so small that we can't even see it, how could they have the impact that they do? Well, they have the impact that they do by behaving as multicellular organisms, by communicating with each other and behaving collectively. And I guess that's what we as humans need to figure out how to do too. If we want to have major change, if we want to have major impact, we have to figure out how to all operate collectively. And we could probably learn a lot from the way microbes do this. Because you would think the microbes aren't as clever as us, because they can't see and they can't speak to each other, they can't hear, and yet they can communicate extremely well. Maybe it's an advantage if you can't see and speak or hear, that maybe you might, and theoretically they don't have any brains either, so how come they're so well organised? Well, they use a system or a process that we call quorum sensing. So in human society, a quorum is actually the minimum number of members of an organisation that have to be present in order for that organisation to make a decision. So you could have some microbes in your gut that can produce vitamins, but not enough for there to be a quorum. And if they don't reach a quorum, once they actually reach a quorum, they will all simultaneously change their genetic... They will switch on genes, let me put it that way. They will have genes, let's say vitamin B, one of the B vitamins. We'll pick one B vitamin and we'll say there's a certain kind of lactobacillus or something that produces that B vitamin. they will be there in your gut, but if there's not enough of them, they won't produce that. And then when they get to a certain concentration, just like we said, we had to have seven of the 10 committee members, they will all simultaneously switch on their genes for making B vitamins. And they will not do it unless there's enough of them. So quorum sensing is like really, really incredibly important, powerful concept to get your head around, because all microbial communities, including the ones in our gut, use this to communicate. And because they then can alter gene expression in their population or in their host, that's why they're so powerful. Because bacteria are extraordinary. So it's density-dependent coordinated behaviour. It occurs in all species of bacteria, archaea, fungi and viruses. So how do they communicate? Well, they produce a signal, a chemical signal. And this is the bit that you have to remember, even if you forget everything else about it. It's these signals that bacteria use that we can use to change the function of biological systems and the function of agricultural systems. So these signals are called autoinducers. That word is going to be, unfortunately, bandied around in the future, just like regenerative agriculture has been bandied around, and everyone will use it and they won't know what it means. But an autoinducer is a signal that a microbe produces to talk to other microbes. And if those microbial signals are not there, then the soil cannot function as a living organism. And that's the problem that we see in modern agriculture today, that soils are not functioning as living beings, and they really are living beings. They should be. So the natural world is composed of interdependent communities of organisms. And as we heard, even with the birch trees growing along the edge of the water and the insects being important to feed the fish. And so we have all these interdependencies and all these connections. And there's really no such thing as an independent organism. I mean, we humans could not survive for probably even 5 minutes without all of the other things on this planet that we depend on, not only for our food but for our oxygen. If we took all other life forms away, I guess it'd be like going to Mars or the moon or something, wouldn't it? So soil structure is incredibly important too. It's not just the nutrients that are in the plants. It's if they're building soil, like if we're putting carbon into the soil, we're building soil structure. And you can't buy that in a bag. That's my big beef about California, is why are there no plants being planted here that will be green over summer, that will keep soil biologically active and growing in summer? Because if it's dead all summer, it is always going to go backwards. And I can't believe that it always was dead over summer, because our Mediterranean environments that are exactly the same as yours, and many of them that were more severe are more severe than yours, especially here in Northern California. We have environments that have much hotter, drier summers than you have here. And at the time of European settlement, they were green, incredibly green. And they're not green now because we lost our warm season ground cover. So the carbon feeds the microbes, and it also gives them substrate to use to make polysaccharides and form these little microaggregates. And then the hyphae of the mycorrhizal fungi and also a lot of saprotrophic fungi that live around plant roots just pull all those particles together to make that macroaggregate. And inside that very specialised structure in soil, the microbes can work together to form humus, which is the holy grail for soil. It has very high cation exchange capacity, very high water holding capacity. It's incredibly important for soil structure, and of course it's important for storing or sequestering atmospheric carbon, because once it's in the form of humus, it's stable for hundreds and sometimes thousands of years. If it's just labile carbon, it's going to go back to the atmosphere. So we want it to be non-labile. Why would they work together in that coordinated fashion to form humus around plant roots? So if the plant isn't actively photosynthesizing, all the microbes around its roots are going to die. So if you were a microbe, would you not do something to change the environment or improve the environment so that that plant photosynthesizes for longer? And if you were in a complex plant community, like let's go back to the prairies again. The prairies had warm season grasses, warm season broadleaves, cool season grasses, cool season broadleaves, or forbs if you want to call them forbs, and somewhere between 500 and 700 different species. I was involved last year in the monitoring of a prairie in Oklahoma that's still in relatively pristine condition. We found 780 species of ground cover plant, and that was typical for prairies. So we're in Oklahoma. It was just near the Noble Research Institute, which is, you've got Oklahoma City, about an hour north of that, that was there. But there was a lot of good ranches around in that area and lots of diversity. And I spoke at the grass-fed exchange in South Dakota last year, one of the other speakers who was there, but we all went on a bus tour to his ranch. He had 2,000 plants, including that included the trees and the shrubs and the ground cover plants, but he had certainly over 1,000 ground cover plants. It's not unusual. Our Australian grasslands had 700 to 800 species in them. And I've been in meadows in England that were, you know, being commercially used, like for dairy meadows, where they have said, we have over 200 grassland plants here in our meadows. So California has been drastically altered. And in fact, the grasses that I can see out there now, most of them are introduced, like they're not Californian grasses. So this humus-rich topsoil is a product. It doesn't just get there by itself. It's a product of photosynthesis and microbial resynthesis. But we've been told, or we haven't been told, but we've tried to replace, in our ignorance, I suppose, and it's no one's fault, we've tried to replace that incredible biological activity that would go on around plant roots in a natural ecosystem with high-analysis fertilisers. But high-analysis fertilisers can't do any of the things that microbes can do for plants, and then the plants are put in a situation where they can't acquire the minerals and trace elements that they need for themselves, for their own immune function, and in the same way that human ecosystems or human metabolic pathways have been impacted by us not having the minerals and trace elements that we need. The effect on plants has been fairly similar, I suppose, in that plants now have increased susceptibility to pests and diseases. Every time I pick up a newspaper that has like an agricultural insert or something in it, I'm reading, oh, there's some new disease in citrus or there's some new disease in soybeans, and it's like, and sometimes there's not even a name for it. It'll be like all the experts are trying to figure out what's gone wrong with this kind of plant. It's not functioning as it should be. Almost every day there's some new thing that's going wrong in agriculture. And look at our own bodies. As I said, we have 80 already autoimmune disorders and now a whole lot of unnamed ones coming onto the scene. It's because they're not functioning effectively. And then what happens in the farming situation or the agricultural situation is that the farmer then has to use insecticides and fungicides because the plant is being attacked by all these things, and you can't afford to lose crop if it's worth, you know, sometimes millions of dollars. That reduces farmers' profits, and then we're adding all these unnecessary chemicals to the food chain. I just wanted to say a few more little things here. One was about flowers, that we really do need more flowers in our systems. We're probably not going to be able to get the native flowers back into areas that have been hugely changed from what they were like at the 600 years ago, whatever number we decided on. But one thing you can do in your vegetable gardens, I'm sure quite a few of you grow veggies at home. This is Gabe Brown's vegetable garden. He grows 3 acres of vegetables by grazing the pastures right down really short several times so that he's more or less compromised the root systems on those grasses. And then he doesn't use any herbicide. He farms 5,000 acres, so he's got machinery that he can do this with, but he direct drills. He puts 20 different kinds of vegetables and 20 different kinds of flowers into the seed box, mixes up all the seed and then just drills it into the pasture and everything that comes up. It comes up so thick that there isn't any room for weeds. It's got so much diversity in it that you don't need any fertiliser. And here he's got, this is his warm season mix, he's got corn and squash, and there will be tomatoes and cucumbers and zucchinis and a whole lot of other things in there, and there will also be parsley and cilantro. And so after he's been picking vegetables for a couple of months, I guess, and he figures it's getting to the end of the time, then he turns the cows in there and he says, you know, the growth rate of young animals is just incredible. They're putting on, you know, 3 or 4 pounds a day in weight because there's just so much variety and so much nutrition in those pastures. And then after the cows have gone through, then he puts the chickens in there and then he puts the pigs in there and they turn the whole thing over, and then it's, the soil is just incredibly rich, and he said the pasture just grows like crazy next year. These incredible pastures that grow because you've had the diversity of plants and the diversity of animals that have come through. So that's one thing, like even if you've got a small-scale vegetable garden, even if it's only just a small area like this, put everything in together and put flowers in with your vegetables. So we need more flowers in all these different situations. But if you put prairie strips through your corn paddocks, you can have 10% of the area taken up with flowers and still produce the same yield as you would if you had 100% corn. And not only that, but you find that you can use less chemicals. And in fact, the people, as you can see with all the different flowers, people talk about all the birds, the butterflies, and all the amazing variety of life that comes along with having all those flowers.
And what a beautiful way to end this episode, imagining these biodiverse fields of flowers with pollinators and vegetables and even fiber crops. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Soil to Soil, a podcast by Fibershed, which is a nonprofit organization based in Northern California on the traditional and ancestral territory of the Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo people.
That was the conclusion of a podcast on soil as a living being with Dr. Christine Jones on Fibershed. She spoke on June 20th, 2019. In her presentation, Christine Jones gave credit to Gabe Brown and his family farm in North Dakota. Here are the highlights from an interview Gabe Brown gave in January 2020. He was a guest on the Leading Voices in Food podcast at Duke University.
Imagine a farm doing such creative work that more than 2,000 people come to visit each year from all 50 states and more than 20 countries outside the U.S. What do you think such a farm might be doing? Our guest, Gabe Brown, can explain. I'm Kelly Brownell, director of the World Food Policy Center at Duke University and professor of public policy at Duke. Welcome to the Leading Voices in Food. Gabe Brown, along with his wife Shelley and son Paul, own and operate Brown's Ranch, a diversified 5,000-acre farm and ranch near Bismarck, North Dakota. They are considered to be leaders in the current soil health movement, which focuses on regeneration rather than depletion of resources. 5,000 acres is huge. What do you grow and raise with all those acres?
Well, 5,000 acres scale in the current production model in North Dakota is not so big. We're an average size operation here, and we run beef cattle. We grass finish beef. We have a flock of sheep, and we grass finish lambs. We have pastured pork. We have about 1,400 laying hens out on pasture. We grow some fruits, some vegetables, and then we do a fair amount of grains also, everything from corn and peas and hard red spring wheat and oats and barley and winter triticale and rye. We also do some honeys. We have some bees on our operation. So it's a very diverse operation.
You've spoken about your farm as an ecosystem. What do you mean by this?
Well, one of the things that I see is wrong, so to speak, with production agriculture today, it has become very singular. And by that, I mean producers, farmers, ranchers, they only have corn, or they have corn and soybeans, or they only have beef cattle, or they only have dairy cattle. They specialize in one specific commodity. Whereas our operation, we have over 17 different enterprises. We have all these different cash crops and cover crops and livestock. And that allows our operation to function more like an ecosystem. And I explain to people, if you can imagine what the Northern Great Plains looked like centuries ago with these herds of bison moving across to the plains, and they were being moved by predators, and there was deer and elk and rabbits and all the insects. Well, that's kind of what it's like on our operation.
Is it fair to say that each piece of this benefits from the others in important ways?
That's exactly right. And you look at how nature functions. In nature, it's not singular. You can't change one thing without it having compounding or cascading effects. And these compounding cascading effects are either positive or negative. And as you stack, so to speak, enterprises, it's going to benefit the resource as a whole. And that's the reason we've been able to take large amounts of carbon out of the atmosphere and move them into the soil and have soils that are much more resilient to these swings in moisture and temperature. That's how nature functions. That's what we're trying to mimic on our ranch.
Gabe, can you give us a concrete example of how you actually do this?
Sure. So when my wife and I purchased this ranch from her parents in 1991, we could only infiltrate a half of an inch of rainfall per hour. That's all that can infiltrate into the soils. And the reason it wasn't more than that is because my father-in-law, for years, he had tilled the soil, which is very destructive, destroys soil aggregates, and it decreases water infiltration. Well, now, today, on those same soils, we're able to infiltrate an inch of rainfall in 9 seconds and the second inch in 16 seconds. Well, think of the ramifications of that. You know, throughout much of the Western U.S. and Southwestern United States, you see decrease in the amount of water in the aquifers, and water is becoming a major issue. Well, if we're able to infiltrate more rainfall and then store that in the soils via organic matter levels, and on our operation, on our ranch, in 1991, organic matter levels were 1.7 to 1.9%. And I use the word organic matter. Think of it as carbon. Organic matter is approximately 58% carbon. Well, historically speaking, in our area, organic matter levels should have been in the 7 to 8% range. Well, we were less than 2%. So in other words, 75% of the carbon had left the soils. And where to go? Well, it's up in the atmosphere. Well, we need to bring that back down into the soils. Now, today, those same fields that were less than 2% organic matter are now in the 7 to 8% organic matter range. And in fact, we have a team of scientists that are doing some major analysis of our soils, and they found we now have 96 tons of carbon per acre stored in our soils. Well, this is approximately four times what they thought that they would find here. So when we hear about there being too much carbon in the atmosphere and we need to sequester it, so to speak, into the soils, well, regenerative agriculture can do that.
Boy, that is so impressive. Why should the general public hear about this?
You look at, and for lack of a better word, just the ills in society today. Look at what we're seeing. We're seeing major nitrification problems in the Gulf of Mexico, in our Great Lakes, in our estuaries on the Chesapeake and on the West Coast. Well, that's too much nutrients are leaving the landscape from production agriculture and from industry being put into the watersheds. Okay, if we heal, so to speak, the farms and ranches, if we grow cover crops, we're able to hold those nutrients on those farms and ranches so they don't end up in our watersheds and in our drinking water, in our oceans and rivers, streams. So that's one small facet. Now you look at what's happening from a human health aspect also. We have a human health crisis in this country, really occurring around the world. You know, I tell people the United States spends more on healthcare than any other country in the world per capita, yet we're now ranked the 35th healthiest country in the world. Well, why is that? Well, part of it's due to our sedentary lifestyle, but part of it is due to the lack of nutrient density in our foods. Well, why don't we have nutrient density in our foods? In order for a plant, and eventually then an animal, if that plant's consumed by an animal, to be nutrient dense, you have to have a healthy functioning soil ecosystem, because that's the only way these plants will get all these plant secondary metabolites. Well, how do we get a healthy soil? It's through regenerative agriculture and using these principles. And then the third component we can say is the carbon in the atmosphere. Okay, we have way too much carbon in the atmosphere, not enough in our soils. So how do we move carbon from the atmosphere down into the soils? It's with living plants, whether it be cash crops, cover crops, but then a very, very important piece of the puzzle is those plants need to be grazed by animals, because that grazing of these plants by animals then signals the plants to release more root exudates, so they can start regrowing, and they will take in more CO2 out of the atmosphere to pump more carbon into the soil. So animals are crucial to this. So I don't care which ill you're talking about that we're facing in society today, regenerative agriculture, more than anything else, has the ability to move us in a positive direction. The beautiful thing about regenerative agriculture, and I tell people this, wherever in the world that you are, that you grow food with soil, regenerative agriculture can take place. Because regenerative agriculture is based on five basic principles. And briefly, those are, number one, we need to have armor on the soil at all times. The soil needs to be covered. You can't see bare soil because then it's prone to wind erosion, water erosion, evaporation. We need diversity. We need diversity in both plants and animal life. Where in nature do you find monocultures? You don't, usually only where man put them. Otherwise, nature is very, very diverse. You need a living root in the soil as long as possible. In other words, a growing plant. Look at our production model today, farming. Farmers grow one crop and then the land sits idle for the majority of the year. That means there's no sunlight being collected. We're not taking carbon out of the atmosphere, pumping it into the soil. And then we also need integration of animals and insects. You know, so often farmers think of insects as pests, but they don't realize for every insect species that's a pest, there's 1,700 that are beneficial. And why do we want to spend our time killing the one pest when we should be proliferating all the insect population and then nature being self-organizing, self-healing, self-regulating will take care of those imbalances. You know, on our operation, we haven't used a pesticide since before the turn of the century. There's no need to, because if you have a healthy functioning ecosystem, those insects will become imbalanced. And then you need the livestock integration and animal integration. And I'm talking about all forms, everything, you know, from beef cattle to rabbits and chickens. And that's how a healthy ecosystem functions. And if you use nature's template, this can take place anywhere in the world where there's production agriculture on land.
These excerpts of a conversation with the regenerative farmer and Chelsea Green author Gabe Brown come from an interview by Kelly Brownell, professor of public policy at Duke University, North Carolina. They spoke on January 9, 2020. The book by Gabe Brown is entitled Dirt to Soil, One Family's Journey into Regenerative Agriculture. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glurden. Thank you for listening.